these at once.
His reasoning is hard to fault.
The walls of Degothka have frustrated you before, Glockta said, but it did not sound convincing even to his own ear.
Hardly the words of a winner.
He felt the eyes of Worms and Visbrook and Ida on him, making his back itch.
Trying to decide who holds the upper hand, and I know who I'd pick in their shoes.
Perhaps some of you have more confidence in your walls than others. I will return at sunset for your answer. The Emperor's offer lasts for this one day only, and will never be repeated. He is merciful, but his mercy has limits. You have until sunset.
And he swept from the room. Glockta waited until the door had clicked shut before he slowly turned his chair around to face the others.
What in hell was that?
He snarled at Visbrook.
The general tugged at his sweaty collar. It was incumbent upon me, as a soldier, to admit an unarmed representative of the enemy in order to hear his terms.
Without telling me?
We knew you would not want to listen, snapped Worms. But he speaks the truth. Despite all our hard work, we are greatly outnumbered and can expect no relief as long as the war drags on in Angland. We are nothing more than a pinprick in the foot of a huge and hostile nation. It might serve as well to negotiate while we still hold a position of some strength. You may depend upon it that we will receive no terms beyond a massacre once the city has fallen.
True enough, but the Archlector is unlikely to agree. Negotiating a surrender was hardly the task for which I was appointed.
You are unusually quiet, Magister Ida.
I am scarcely qualified to speak on the military aspects of such a decision, but, as it turns out, his terms are generous. One thing is certain. If we refuse this offer, and the Gurkish do take the city by force, the slaughter will be terrible.
She looked up at Glockta.
There will be no mercy then.
All too true. On Gurkish mercy, I am the expert. So, all three of you are for capitulation?
They looked at each other and said nothing.
It has not occurred to you that once we surrender, they might not honor your little agreement?
It had occurred, said Visbrook. But they have honored their agreements before, and surely some hope, and he looked down at the tabletop, is better than none.
You have more confidence in our enemy than in me, it would seem. Hardly that surprising. My own confidence could be higher.
Glockta wiped some wet from under his eye.
I see. Then I suppose I must consider his offer. We will reconvene when our Gurkish friend returns, at sunset.
He rocked his body back and winced as he pushed himself up.
"You consider it,"
hissed Vitari in his ear as he limped down the hall away from the audience chamber.
"You fucking consider it." "That's right," snapped Glockta. "I make the decisions here. Or you let those worms make them for you. We've each got our jobs. I don't tell you how to write your little reports to the Archlector. How I manage those worms is none of your concern."
"None of my concern."
Vitari snatched hold of Glockta's arm, and he tottered on his weak leg. She was stronger than she looked, a lot stronger.
"I told Salt you could handle things," she snarled in his face. "If we lose the city without so much as a fight even, it's both our heads. And my head is my concern, cripple."
"This is no time to panic," growled Glockta. "I don't want to end up floating in the docks any more than you do, but this is a delicate balance. Let them think they might get their way, then no one will make any rash moves, not until I'm good and ready. Understand me when I say, practical, that this will be the first and the last time that I explain myself to you. Now take your fucking hand off me."
Her hand did not let go, Rather, the fingers tightened, cutting into Glockta's arm as hard as a vice. Her eyes narrowed, furious lines cut into her freckled face at their corners.
Might I have misjudged her? Might she be about to cut my throat?
He almost grinned at the thought. But Severard chose that moment to step out of the shadows further down the dim hall.
Look at the two of you, he murmured as he padded towards them. It always amazes me how love blooms in the least likely places and between the least likely people. A rose forcing its way through the stony ground.
He pressed his hands to his chest.
It warms my heart. Have we got him? Of course, soon as he stepped out of the audience chamber.
Vitari's hand had gone limp, and Glockta brushed it off and began to shuffle towards the cells.
Why don't you come with us?
He called over his shoulder, having to stop himself rubbing the bruised flesh on his arm.
You can put this in your next report to Salt.
Shabed al-Islek Burai looked considerably less majestic sitting down, particularly in a scarred, stained chair in one of the close and sweaty cells beneath the citadel.
Now, isn't this better, to speak on level terms? Quite disconcerting having you looming over me like that.
Islik sneered and looked away, as though talking to Glockta were a task far beneath him.
A rich man harassed by beggars in the street, but we'll soon cure him of that illusion. We know we have a traitor within our walls, within the ruling council itself, most likely one of those three worthies to whom you were just now giving your little ultimatum. You will tell me who.
No response.
I am merciful,
exclaimed Glockta, waving his hand airily as the ambassador himself had done but a few short minutes before.
But my mercy has limits. Speak.
I am here under a flag of parley, on a mission from the Emperor himself. To harm an unarmed emissary would be expressly against the rules of war.
Parley? Rules of war?
Glockta chuckled. Severard chuckled. Vitari chuckled. Frost was silent.
Do they even have those anymore?
Save that rubbish for children like Vithbrook. That's not the way grown-ups play the game. Who is the traitor?
I pity you, cripple. When the city falls...
Save your pity, you'll need it for yourself.
Frost's fist scarcely made any sound as it sank into the ambassador's stomach. His eyes bulged out, his mouth hung open, he coughed a dry cough, somewhere close to vomiting, tried to breathe, and coughed again.
Strange, isn't it?
Mused Glockta as he watched him struggle for air. Big men, small men, thin men, fat men, clever men, stupid men, they all respond the same to a fist in the guts. One minute you think you're the most powerful man in the world, the next you can't even breathe by yourself. Some kinds of power are nothing but tricks of the mind. Your people taught me that, below your emperor's palace. There were no rules of war there, I can tell you.
You know all about certain engagements, and certain bridges, and certain young officers, so you know that I've been just where you are now. There is one difference, however. I was helpless, but you can stop this unpleasantness at any time. You need only tell me who the traitor is, and you will be spared.
Islik had got his breath back now, though a good deal of his arrogance is gone, one suspects for good.
I know nothing of any traitor.
Really? Your master, the Emperor, sends you here to negotiate without all the facts? Unlikely. But if it's true, you really aren't any use to me at all, are you?
Islik swallowed.
I know nothing of any traitor.
We'll see.
Frost's big white fist clubbed him in the face. It would have thrown him sideways if the albino's other fist hadn't caught his head before it fell, smashed his nose, and knocked him clean over the back of the chair. Frost and Severard dragged him up between them, righted the chair, and dumped him gasping into it. Vitari looked on, arms folded.
"All very painful," said Glockter.
"But pain can be put to one side if one knows that it will not last long. If it cannot last, say, past sunset. To truly break a man quickly, you have to threaten to deprive him of something. To hurt him in a way that will never heal. I should know."
"Gah!"
squawked the ambassador, thrashing in his chair. Severard wiped his knife on the shoulder of the man's white robe, then tossed his ear onto the table. It lay there on the wood, a forlorn and bloody half-circle of flesh. Glockter stared at it.
"In a baking cell just like this, over the course of long months, the Emperor's servants turned me into this revolting, twisted mockery of a man. One might have hoped that the chance at doing the same to one of them, the chance at cutting out vengeance pound for pound, would provide some dull flicker of pleasure. And yet he felt nothing. Nothing but my own pain."
He winced as he stretched his leg out and felt the knee click, hissed air through his empty gums.
"So why do I do this?"
Glockter sighed.
"Next will come a toe, then a finger, an eye, a hand, your nose, and so on. Do you see? It'll be at least an hour before you're missed, and we are quick workers."
Glockter nodded at the severed ear.
"We could have a pile of your flesh a foot high by that time. I'll carve you until you're nothing but a tongue and a bag of guts, if that's what it takes. But I'll know who the traitor is, that I promise you. Well, do you know anything yet?"
The ambassador stared at him, breathing hard, dark blood running from his magnificent nose, down his chin, dripping from the side of his head.
"Speechless with shock, or thinking on his next move, it hardly matters."
"I grow bored. Start on his hands, Frost." The albino seized hold of his wrist.
"Wait!"
wailed the ambassador.
"God help me! Wait! It was Worms. Course and then Worms, the governor's own son."
"Worms. Almost too obvious. But then again, the most obvious answers are usually the right ones. That little bastard would sell his own father if he only thought that he could find a buyer."
"And the woman, Ida?"
Glockter frowned.
"Ida? You sure?"
"She planned it. She planned the whole thing."
Glockter sucked slowly at his empty gums. They tasted sour.
"An awful sense of disappointment, or an awful sense of having known all along. She was always the one with the brains, or the guts, or the resources for treason. A shame, but we know better than to hope for happy endings." "Ida and Worms," muttered Glockter. "Worms and Ida. Our sordid little mystery comes to a close."
He looked up at Frost.
"You know what to do."
Chapter 19. Long Odds. The hill rose out of the grass, a round, even cone like a thing man-made. Strange, this one great mound standing out in the midst of the level plain. Pharaoh did not trust it. Weathered stones stood in a rough circle around its top and scattered about the slopes, some up on end, some lying on their sides, the smallest no more than knee-high, the biggest twice as tall as a man. Dark, bare stones standing defiant against the wind. Ancient, cold, angry. Pharaoh frowned at them. It felt as though they frowned back.
"What is this place?" asked Nine Fingers.
Kwai shrugged.
"Old is what this place is. Terribly old. Older than the Empire itself.
built before the time of Eos, perhaps, when devils roamed the earth. He grinned. Built by devils, for all I know. Who can say? Some temple to forgotten gods? Some tomb?
Our tomb, whispered Pharaoh.
What? Good place to stop, she said out loud. Get a look across the plain. Nine Fingers frowned up at it. All right, we stop. Pharaoh stood on one of the stones, hands on hips, staring out across the plain through narrowed eyes. The wind tore at the grass and made waves from it, like the waves on the sea. It tore at the great clouds, too, twisting them, ripping them open, dragging them through the sky. It lashed at Pharaoh's face, nipped at her eyes, but she ignored it. Damn wind, just like always. Nine Fingers stood beside her, squinting into the cold sun. Anything out there?
We are followed.
They were far away, but she could see them. Tiny dots in the far distance. Tiny riders moving on the ocean of grass. Nine Fingers grimaced.
You sure?
Yes.
You surprised?
No.
He gave up looking and rubbed at his eyes.
Bad news is never a surprise, just a disappointment.
I count 13.
You can count 'em? I can't even see 'em. They're coming for us.
She raised her arms.
You see anything else out here? Might be that laughing bastard Phineas found some more friends.
Shit.
He looked down at the cart, drawn up at the base of the hill.
We can't outrun them.
No.
She curled her lip.
You could ask the spirits for their opinion.
So they could tell us what, that we're fucked?
Silence for a moment.
Better to wait and fight them here. Bring the cart up to the top. At least we've got a hill and a few rocks to hide behind.
That's what I was thinking. Gives us time to prepare the ground.
All right, we'd best get to it.
The point of the shovel bit into the ground with the sharp scrape of metal on earth. An all-too-familiar sound. Digging pits and digging graves. What was the difference? Pharaoh had dug graves for all kinds of people. Companions, or as close as she had come to companions. Friends, or as close as she had come to friends. A lover or two, if you could call them that. Bandits, killers, slaves. Whoever hated the Gurkish. Whoever hid in the Badlands, for whatever reason. Spade up and spade down. When the fighting is over, you dig, if you are still alive. You gather up the bodies in a line. You dig the graves in a row. You dig for your fallen comrades. You're slashed, you're punctured, you're hacked, and you're broken comrades. You dig as deep as you can be bothered. You dump them in, you cover them up, they rot away and are forgotten, and you go on alone. That's the way it's always been. But here, on this strange hill, in the middle of this strange country, there was still time, still a chance for the comrades to live. That was the difference, and for all her scorn and her scowls and her anger, she clung to it as she clung to the spade, desperate tight. Strange how she never stopped hoping.
"You dig well," said Nine Fingers.
She squinted up at him, standing over her at the edge of the pit.
Lots of practice.
She dug the spade into the earth beside the hole, planted her hands on the sides, and jumped out, sat on the edge with her legs hanging down. Her shirt was stuck to her with sweat, her face was running with it. She wiped her forehead with her dirty hand. He handed her the water skin, and she took it from him, pulled the stopper out with her teeth.
How long do we have?
She sucked a mouthful out of the skin and worked it round, spat it out.
Depends how hard they go.
She took another mouthful and swallowed.
They're going hard now. They keep that up. They could be on us late tonight, or maybe dawn tomorrow.
She handed the skin back.
Dawn tomorrow.
Nine Fingers slowly pushed the stopper back in.
13, you said, eh?
13.
And 4 of us.
5, if the navigator comes to help.
Nine Fingers scratched at his jaw.
Not very likely.
That apprentice any use in a fight?
Nine Fingers winced. Not much.
How about Luther?
I'd be surprised if he's ever thrown a fist in anger, let alone a blade. Pharaoh nodded.
13 against 2, then.
Long odds.
Very.
He took a deep breath and stared down into the pit. If you had a mind to run, I can't say I'd blame you.
Duh!
She snorted. Strange, but she hadn't even thought about it.
I'll stick. See how it turns out.
All right. Good. Can't say I don't need you. The wind rustled in the grass and sighed against the stones. There were things that should be said at a time like this, Pharaoh guessed, but she did not know what. She had never had much talk in her.
One thing. If I die, you bury me.
She held her hand out to him.
Deal?
He raised an eyebrow at it.
Done.
It was a long time, she realized, since she touched another person without the purpose of hurting them. It was a strange feeling, his hand gripped in hers, his fingers tight round hers, his palm pressed against hers. Warm. He nodded at her, she nodded at him, then they let go.
What if we both die? He said.
She shrugged.
Then the crows can pick us clean. After all, what's the difference?
Not much, he muttered, starting off down the slope. Not much. Chapter 20 The Road to Victory. West stood by a clump of stunted trees in the cutting wind on the high ground above the River Cumna and watched the long column move. More accurately, he watched it not move. The neat blocks of the King's Own, up at the head of Prince Ladislaw's army, marched smartly enough. You could tell them from their armour, glinting in the odd ray of pale sun that broke through the ragged clouds, from the bright uniforms of their officers, from the red and golden standards snapping at the front of each company. They were already across the river, formed up in good order, a stark contrast with the chaos on the other side. The levies had started eagerly, early that morning, no doubt relieved to be leaving the miserable camp behind, but it hadn't been an hour before a man here or a man there, older than the others or worse shod, had started to lag and the column had grown ragged. Men slipped and stumbled in the half-frozen muck, cursing and barging into their neighbours, boots tripping on the boots of the man in front. The battalions had twisted, stretched, turned from neat blocks into shapeless blobs, merged with the units in front and behind until the column moved in great ripples, one group hurrying forward while the next was still, like the segments of some monstrous, filthy earthworm. As soon as they reached the bridge, they had lost all semblance of order. The ragged companies squeezed into that narrow space, shoving and grunting, tired and bad-tempered. Those waiting behind pressed in tighter and tighter, impatient to be across so they could rest, slowing everything down still further with the weight of their bodies. Then a cart, which had no business being there in any case, had lost a wheel halfway across, and the sluggish flow of men over the bridge had become a trickle. No one seemed to know how to move it, or who to get to fix it, and contented themselves with clambering over it, or slithering around it, and holding up the thousands behind. Quite a press had built up in the mud on this side of the fast-flowing water. Men barged and grumbled shoulder to shoulder, spears sticking up into the air at all angles, surrounded by shouting officers, and an ever-increasing detritus of rubbish and discarded gear. Behind them, the great snake of shambling men continued its spastic forward movement, feeding ever more soldiers into the confusion before the bridge. There was not the slightest evidence that anyone had even thought about trying to make them stop, let alone succeeded. All this in column, under no pressure from the enemy, and with a half-decent road to march on. West dreaded to imagine trying to maneuver them in a battle line, through trees or over broken ground. He jammed his tired eyes shut, rubbed at them with his fingers, but when he opened them, the horrifying, hilarious spectacle was still there before him. He hardly knew whether to laugh or cry. He heard the sound of hooves on the rise behind him, Lieutenant Jallanhorm, big and solid in his saddle. Short on imagination, perhaps, but a fine rider and a trustworthy man. A good choice for the task that West had in mind. "Lieutenant Jallanhorm reporting, sir." The big man turned in his saddle and looked down towards the river. "Looks like they're having some trouble on the bridge."
"Doesn't it, just? Only the start of our troubles, I fear."
Jallanhorm grinned down.
"I understand we have the advantage of numbers, and of surprise." "As far as numbers go, maybe. Surprise."
West gestured down at the men milling around on the bridge, heard the vague, desperate shouts of their officers.
"This rabble? A blind man would hear us coming from 10 miles distance. A blind and a deaf one would probably smell us before we were halfway to battle order. We'll be all day just getting across the river, and that's hardly the worst of our shortcomings. In the area of command, I fear, the gulf between us and our enemy could not possibly be wider. The prince lives in a dream, and his staff exist only to keep him there at any price. But surely, the price could be our lives."
Jallanhorm frowned.
"Come on, West. I hardly want to be going into battle with that thought first on me mind."
"You won't be going."
"I won't?"
"You will pick out 6 good men from your company with spare mounts. You will ride as hard as possible for Austenholm, then north to Lord Marshal Burr's camp."
West reached into his coat and pulled out his letter. "You will give him this. You will inform him that Bethod is already behind him with the greater part of his strength, and that Prince Ladislaw has most ill-advisedly decided to cross the River Cumna and give the Northmen battle directly against the Marshal's orders."
West clenched his teeth.
"Bethod will see us coming from miles away. We are handing the choice of the ground to our enemy, so that Prince Ladislaw can appear bold." "Boldness is the best policy in war, apparently."
"West, surely it's not that bad."
"When you reach Marshal Burr, tell him that Prince Ladislaw has almost certainly been defeated, quite possibly destroyed, and the road to Austenholm left open. He'll know what to do."
Jallanhorm stared down at the letter, reached out to take it, then paused.
"Colonel, I really wish that you'd send someone else. I should fight." "Your fighting cannot possibly make any real difference, Lieutenant, but your carrying this message might. There is no sentiment in this, believe me. I have no more important task than this one, and you are the man I trust to get it done. Do you understand your orders?"
The big man swallowed, then he took the letter, undid a button, and slid it carefully down inside his coat.
"Of course, sir. I'm honored to carry it."
He began to turn his horse.
"There is one more thing."
West took a deep breath.
"If I should get myself killed, when this is over, could you carry a message to my sister?"
"Come on, there'll be no need for—"
"I hope to live, believe me. But this is war. Not everyone will. If I don't come back, just tell Ardy—"
He thought about it for a moment.
"Just tell her I'm sorry. That's all."
"Of course. But I hope you'll tell her yourself."
"So do I. Good luck."
West held out his hand. Jallanhorm reached down and squeezed it in his own.
"And to you."
He spurred his mount down the rise away from the river. West watched him go for a minute, then he took a deep breath and set off in the other direction towards the bridge. Someone had to get that damn column moving again. Chapter 21 Necessary Evils. The sun was half a shimmering golden disk beyond the land walls, throwing orange light into the hallway down which Glockter shuffled, practical frost looming at his shoulder. Through the windows, as he passed painfully by, he could see the buildings of the city casting long shadows up towards the rock. He could almost tell, at each window that he came to, that the shadows were longer and less distinct, the sun was dimmer and colder. Soon it would be gone. Soon it will be night. He paused for a moment before the doors to the audience chamber, catching his breath, letting the ache in his leg subside, licking at his empty gums.
"Give me the bag, then."
Frost handed him the sack, put one white hand against the doors.
"You ready?"
he mumbled.
"Ready as I'll ever be. Let's get on with it."
General Visbrook was sitting stiff in his well-starched uniform, jowls bulging slightly over his high collar, hands plucking nervously at each other. Corsten Dan Worms was doing his best to look nonchalant, but his darting tongue betrayed his anxiety. Magister Ida was sitting upright, hands clasped on the table before her, face stern.
All business.
A necklace of large rubies glowed with the last embers of the setting sun.
Didn't take her too long to find some more jewels, I see.
There was one more member of the gathering, and he showed not the slightest sign of nerves. Nikomo Koska was lounging against the far wall, not far behind his employer, arms crossed over his black breastplate. Glockter noted that he had a sword at his hip and a long dagger at the other.
"What's he doing here?"
"This concerns everyone in the city," said Ida calmly. "It is too important a decision for you to make alone."
"So, he's going to ensure that you get a fair say, eh?"
Koska shrugged and examined his dirty fingernails.
"And what of the writ, signed by all 12 chairs on the closed council? Your paper will not save us from the Emperor's vengeance if the Gurkish take the city."
"I see. So you have it in mind to defy me, to defy the Archlector, to defy the King?"
"I have it in mind to hear out the Gurkish emissary and to consider the facts."
"Very well," said Glockter.
He stepped forwards and upended the bag.
"Give him your ear."
Islik's head dropped onto the table with a hollow clonking sound. It had no expression to speak of, beyond an awful slackness, eyes open and staring off in different directions, tongue lolling slightly. It rolled awkwardly along the beautiful tabletop, leaving an uneven curve of bloody smears on the brightly polished wood, and came to rest face up just in front of General Visbrook.
"A touch theatrical, perhaps, but dramatic. You'd have to give me that. No one can be left in any doubt as to my level of commitment."
Visbrook gawped down at the bloody head on the table before him, his mouth slowly falling further and further open. He started up from his seat and stumbled back, his chair clattering over on the tiles. He raised a shaking finger to point at Glockter.
"You're mad! You're mad! There'll be no mercy for anyone! Every man, woman, and child in Dagoskar! If the city falls now, there's no hope for any of us!"
Glockter smiled his toothless smile.
"Then I suggest that every one of you commits themselves wholeheartedly to ensuring that the city does not fall."
He looked over at Corsten Dan Worms.
"Unless it's already too late for that, eh? Unless you've already sold the city to the Gurkish and you can't go back."
Worms' eyes flickered to the door, to Koska, to the horrified General Visbrook, to Frost, hulking ominous in the corner, and finally to Magister Ida, still sitting steely calm and composed.
"And our little conspiracy is jerked from the shadows."
"He knows!"
screamed Worms, shoving back his chair and stumbling up, taking a step towards the windows.
"Clearly he knows."
"Then do something, dammit!"
"I already have," said Ida.
"By now, Koska's men will have seized the land walls, bridged your channel, and opened the gates to the Gurkish. The docks, the great temple, and even the citadel itself are also in their hands."
There was a faint rattling beyond the door.
"I do believe that I can hear them now, just outside. I am sorry, Superior Glockter, indeed I am. You have done everything His Eminence could have expected, and more. But the Gurkish will already be pouring into the city. You see that further resistance is pointless."
Glockter looked up at Koska.
May I retort?
The Styrian gave a small smile, a stiff bow.
Most kind. I hate to disappoint you, but the gates are in the hands of Haddish Kadia and several of his most committed priests. He said that he would open them to the Gurkish, what with his phrase, when God himself commanded it. Do you have a divine visitation planned?
It was plain from Ida's face that she did not.
As for the citadel, it has been seized by the Inquisition, for the safety of His Majesty's loyal subjects, of course. Those are my practicals that you can hear outside. As for Master Koska's mercenaries, at their posts on the walls, Superior, as ordered.
The Styrian snapped his heels together and gave an impeccable salute.
They stand ready to repel any assault by the Gurkish.
He grinned down at Ida.
I do apologize that I must leave your service at such a crucial time, Magister, but you understand that I had a better offer.
There was a stunned pause. Visbrook could hardly have looked more flabbergasted if he had been struck by lightning. Worms stared around, wild-eyed. He took one more step back, and Frost took a stride towards him. Magister Ida's face had drained of color.
And so the chase ends, and the foxes are at bay.
You should hardly be surprised. Glockter settled back comfortably in his chair.
Nikomo Kothka's disloyalty is a legend throughout the circle of the world. There's hardly a land under the sun in which he hasn't betrayed an employer.
The Styrian smiled and bowed once more.
It is your wealth, muttered Ida, not his disloyalty, that surprises me. Where did you get it?
Glockter grinned. The world is full of surprises.
You fucking stupid bitch!
Screamed Worms. His steel was only halfway out before Frost's white fist crunched into his jaw and flung him senseless against the wall. Almost at the same moment, the doors crashed open and Vitari burst into the room, half a dozen practicals behind her, weapons at the ready.
Everything all right? She asked.
Actually, we're just finishing up. Take out the rubbish, would you, Frost?
The albino's fingers closed around Verm's ankle and hauled him bodily across the floor and out of the audience chamber. Ida watched his slack face slide across the tiles, then looked up at Glockter.
What now?
Now the fells.
Then?
Then we'll see.
He snapped his fingers at the practicals, jerked his thumb towards the door. Two of them tramped round the table, seized the Queen of Merchants by her elbows, and bundled her impassively out of the room.
So, asked Glockter, looking over at Visbrook, does anyone else wish to accept the ambassador's offer of surrender?
The general, who had been standing silently the whole time, snapped his mouth shut, took a deep breath, and stood to stiff attention.
I am a simple soldier. Of course I will obey any order from His Majesty or His Majesty's chosen representative. If the order is to hold Degoska to the last man, I will give the last drop of my blood to do it. I assure you that I knew nothing of any plot. I acted rashly, perhaps, but at all times honestly, in what I felt were the best interests of—
Glockter waved his hand.
I am convinced. Bored, but convinced.
I have already lost half the ruling council today. To lose any more might make me look greedy.
The Gurkish will no doubt make their assault at first light. You should look to our defenses, General.
Visbrook closed his eyes, swallowed, wiped some sweat from his forehead.
You will not regret your faith in me, Superior.
I trust that I will not. Go.
The general hurried from the room, as though worried that Glockter might change his mind, and the rest of the practicals followed him. Vitari bent and lifted Verm's fallen chair and slid it carefully back under the table.
A neat job. She nodded slowly to herself. Very neat. I'm happy to say I was right about you all along.
Glockter snorted.
Your approval is worth less to me than you can ever know.
Her eyes smiled at him above her mask.
I didn't say that I approved. I just said that it was neat.
And she turned and sauntered out into the hallway. That only left him and Koska. The mercenary leaned against the wall, arms folded carelessly across his breastplate, regarding Glockter with a faint smile. He had not moved the whole time.
You'd do well in Styria, I think. Very ruthless, is that the word? Anyway,
and he gave a flamboyant shrug,
I look forward very much to serving with you.
Until such time as someone offers you more, eh, Koska?
The mercenary waved a hand at the severed head on the table.
Would you like me to do something with that?
Stick it on the battlements of the land walls, somewhere it can be easily seen. Let the Gurkish understand the strength of our resolve.
Koska clicked his tongue.
Heads on spikes, eh?
He dragged the head off the table by its long beard.
Never goes out of fashion.
The doors clicked shut behind him, and Glockter was left alone in the audience chamber. He rubbed at his stiff neck, stretched his stiff leg out beneath the bloody table.
A good day's work, all in all. But the day is over now.
Outside the tall windows, the sun had finally set over Dagoska. The sky was dark. Chapter 22 Among the Stones. The first traces of dawn were creeping over the plain, a glimmer of light on the undersides of the towering clouds and along the edges of the ancient stones, a muddy flare on the eastern horizon. A sight a man rarely saw, that first grey glow, or one that Giselle had rarely seen anyway. At home he would have been safely in his quarters now, sleeping soundly in a warm bed. None of them had slept last night. They had spent the long, cold hours in silence, sitting in the wind, peering into the dark for shapes out on the plain, and waiting. Waiting for the dawn. Nine Fingers frowned at the rising sun.
Almost time. Soon they'll be coming.
Right,
muttered Giselle numbly.
Listen to me now. Stay here and watch the cart. There's plenty of them, and more than likely some will get round the back of us. That's why you're here, you understand?
Giselle swallowed. His throat was tight with the tension. All he could think about was how unfair it was. How unfair that he should die so young.
All right. Me and her will be round the front of the hill there in around the stones. Most of them will come up that way, I reckon. You get in trouble, you shout for us. But if we don't come, well, do what you can. Might be we're busy, might be we're dead.
I'm scared,
said Giselle. He hadn't meant to say it, but it hardly seemed to matter now. Nine Fingers only nodded, though.
And me. We're all scared.
Pharaoh had a fierce smile on her face as she tightened the straps of her quiver around her chest, pulled the buckle on her sword belt one notch further, dragged on her archery guard and worked her fingers, twanged at her bowstring, everything neat and quick and ready for violence. While she prepared for a fight that would most likely be the death of them all, she looked as Giselle might have done dressing for a night round the taverns of Adua. Yellow eyes shining, excited in the half-light, as if she couldn't wait to get started. He had never seen her look happy before.
She doesn't look scared, he said.
Nine Fingers frowned over at her.
Well, maybe not her, but she's not an example I'd want to follow.
He watched her for a moment.
Sometimes, when someone lives in danger for too long, the only time they feel alive is when death's breathing on their shoulder.
Right,
muttered Giselle. The sight of the buckle on his own sword belt, of the grips of his own steel, so proudly polished, made him feel sick now. He swallowed again.
Damn it, but his mouth had never been so full of spit. Try to think about something else.
Like what?
Whatever gets you through it. You got family?
A father, two brothers. I don't know how much they like me.
Shit on them, then. You got children?
No.
Wife?
No. Giselle grimaced. He had done nothing with his life but play cards and make enemies. No one would miss him.
A lover, then? Don't tell me there ain't a girl waiting.
Well, maybe. But he did not doubt that Ardy would already have found someone else. She had never seemed overly sentimental. Perhaps he should have offered to marry her when he had the chance. At least then someone might have wept for him.
What about you?
He mumbled.
What, a family?
Nine Fingers frowned, rubbing grimly at the stump of his middle finger.
I did have one. And now I've got another. You don't pick your family, you take what you're given and you make the best of it.
He pointed at Pharaoh, then at Kwai.
You see her, and him, and you?
He slapped his hand down on Giselle's shoulder.
That's my family now, and I don't plan on losing a brother today, you understand?
Giselle nodded slowly. You don't pick your family, you make the best of it. Ugly, stupid, stinking, strange, it hardly seemed to matter now. Nine Fingers held out his hand, and Giselle gripped it in his own as hard as he could. The Northman grinned.
Luck then, Giselle.
And to you.
Pharaoh knelt beside one of the pitted stones, her bow in one hand, an arrow nocked and ready. The wind made patterns in the tall grass on the plain below, whipped at the shorter grass on the slope of the hill, plucked at the flights of the seven arrows stuck into the earth in front of her in a row. Seven arrows was all she had left. Nothing like enough. She watched them ride up to the base of the hill. She watched them climb from their horses, staring upwards. She watched them tighten the buckles on their scuffed leather armor, ready their weapons. Spears, swords, shields, a bow or two. She counted them. 13. She had been right. But that wasn't much of a comfort. She recognized Phineas, laughing and pointing up at the stones. Bastard. She would shoot him first if she got the chance, but there was no point risking a shot at this range. They would be coming soon, crossing the open ground, struggling uphill. She could shoot them then. They began to spread out, peering up at the stones over the tops of their shields, their boots rustling in the long grass below. They had not seen her yet. There was one at the front without a shield, pounding up the slope with a fierce grin on his face, a bright sword in each hand. She drew the string back, unhurried, felt it dig reassuringly into her chin. The arrow took him in the center of his chest, right through his leather breastplate. He sank to his knees, wincing and gasping. He pushed himself up with one of his swords, took a lurching step. Her second arrow stuck into his body just above the first, and he fell to his knees again, dribbled bloody spit onto the hillside, then rolled onto his back. But there were plenty more, and still coming on. The nearest one was hunched down behind a big shield, pressing slowly up the slope, with it held in front of him, trying not to expose a single inch of flesh. Her arrow thudded into the edge of the heavy wood. "Psst," she hissed, snatching another shaft from the earth. She drew back the string again, taking careful aim.
"Ah!"
he cried, as the arrow stuck him through his exposed ankle. The shield faltered and wobbled, drifted to the side. Her next shaft arced through the air and caught him cleanly through the neck, just above the shield rim. Blood bubbled down his skin, his eyes went wide, and he toppled backwards, the shield sliding down the slope after him, with her wasted arrows sticking from it. But that one had taken too long and too many shafts. They were well up the hillside now, halfway to the first stones, zigzagging left and right. She snatched her last two arrows from the earth and slithered through the grass up the slope. That was all she could do for now. Nine Fingers would have to look after himself. Logan waited, his back pressed against the stone, trying to keep his breathing quiet. He watched Pharaoh crawl further up the hill away from him.
"Shit," he muttered.
Outnumbered and in trouble yet again. He had known this would happen from the first moment he took charge. It always did. Well, He'd fought his way out of scrapes before, and he would fight his way out of this one now. Say one thing for Logan Ninefingers, say he's a fighter. He heard hurrying footsteps in the grass and breathless grunting. A man laboring up the hill just to the left of the stone. Logan held his sword by his right side, fingered the hard metal of the grip, clenched his jaws together. He saw the point of the man's spear wobble past, then his shield. He stepped out with a fighting roar, swinging the sword round in a great wide circle. It chopped deep into the man's shoulder and opened a huge gash across his chest, spraying blood into the air, lifting him off his feet and sending him crashing down the hill, flopping over and over.
"Still alive,"
Logan panted as he sprinted away up the slope. A spear whistled past and sank into the turf beside him as he slid in behind the next stone. A poor effort, but they'd have plenty more. He peered round the edge. He saw quick shapes rushing from rock to rock. He licked his lips and hefted the Maker's sword. There was blood on the dark blade now, blood on the silver letter near the hilt. But there was much more work to do. He came up the hillside towards her, peering over the top of his shield, ready to block an arrow if it came. No way to get at him from here, he was watching too hard. She ducked away behind the stone and slipped into the shallow trench she had dug, started crawling. She came up to the far end, just behind another great rock. She edged round behind it and peered out. She could see him, his side to her, creeping up carefully towards the stone where she had been hiding. It seemed that God was feeling generous today. Towards her, if not towards him. The shaft buried itself in his side, just above his waist. He stumbled, stared down at it. She pulled out her last arrow and knocked it. He was trying to pull the first one out when the second one stuck him in the middle of his chest. Right through the heart, she guessed, from the way he fell. The arrows were gone. Pharaoh tossed her bow away and drew out the Gurkish sword. It was time to get close. Logan stepped round one of the stones and found himself looking straight into a face, close enough almost to feel its breath on his cheek. A young face. A good-looking one, with clean skin and a sharp nose, wide-open brown eyes. Logan smashed his forehead into it. The head snapped back, and the young man stumbled, enough time for Logan to pull his knife from his belt with his left hand. He let go of his sword, grabbed the edge of the man's shield, and tore it out of the way. Brown Eye's head came up again, blood bubbling from his broken nose, snarling as he pulled back his sword arm for a thrust. Logan grunted as he stabbed the knife into the man's body. Once, twice, three times. Hard, fast, underhand thrusts that half lifted him off his feet. Blood leaked out from the holes in his guts and over Logan's hands. He groaned, dropped his sword, started to slide down the stone, his legs giving way, and Logan watched him go. A choice between killing and dying is no choice at all. You have to be realistic about these things. The man sat in the grass, holding his bloody stomach. He looked up at Logan. He grunted. What? Nothing else. His brown eyes were glassy.
Come on! Screamed Pharaoh. Come on, you fucking son of a whore!
She squatted on the grass, ready to spring. He did not speak her language, but he got the gist. His spear arced, spinning through the air. Not a bad throw. She moved to the side, and it clattered away into the stones. She laughed at him, and he came charging. A big, bald bull of a man. 15 strides away, and she could see the grain on the handle of his axe. 12 strides, and she could see the creases on his snarling face, the lines at the corners of his eyes, across the bridge of his nose. 8 strides, and she could see the scratches on his leather breastplate. 5 strides, and he raised his axe high. He squealed as the grass in front of her suddenly collapsed beneath his feet, and he pitched flailing into one of the pits, the weapon flying from his hand. Should have watched where he stabbed. She sprang forward hungrily, swinging the sword without looking. He yelled as the heavy blade bit deep into his shoulder, squealed and gibbered, trying to get away, scrambling at the loose earth. The sword chopped a hole in the top of his head, and he gurgled, thrashed, slid down into the bottom of the pit. The grave. His grave.
He did not deserve one, but never mind. She could drag him out later and let him rot on the hillside. He was a big bastard, this one, a great fat giant of a man, half a head taller than Logan. He had a huge club, big as half a tree, but he threw it around easily enough, shouting and roaring like a madman, little eyes rolling with fury in his pudgy face. Logan dodged and tottered between the stones. Not easy, trying to keep one eye on the ground behind him and one on that huge flailing tree limb. Not easy. Something was bound to go wrong. Logan stumbled on something. The boot of the brown-eyed man he'd killed a minute before. There's justice for you. He righted himself just in time to see the giant's fist crack him in the mouth. He waddled, dizzy, spitting blood. He saw the club swinging at him, and he leapt back. Not far enough. The very tip of the great lump of wood clipped Logan's thigh and nearly dragged him off his feet. He staggered against one of the stones, squawking and dribbling and grimacing from the pain, fumbled his sword and nearly stabbed himself with it, snatched it up just in time to tumble and fall on his back as the club smashed away a great chunk of rock beside him. The giant lifted his club high over his head, bellowing like a bull. A fearsome move, perhaps, but not a clever one. Logan sat up and stabbed him through his gut, the dark blade sliding right up to the hilt almost, clean through his back. The club dropped from his hands and thudded on the turf behind him, but with some last desperate effort, he leaned down, grabbed hold of a fistful of Logan's shirt, and hauled him close, roaring and baring his bloody teeth. He started to raise his great ham of a fist. Logan pulled the knife out of his boot and rammed the blade into the side of the giant's neck. He looked surprised for just a moment, then blood dribbled from his mouth and down his chin. He let go of Logan's shirt, stumbled back, spun slowly round, bounced off one of the stones, and crashed on his face. Seemed that Logan's father had been right. You can never have too many knives. Pharaoh heard the bowstring, but by then it was too late. She felt the arrow pierce her through the back of her shoulder, and when she looked down, she could see the point sticking out the front of her shirt. It made her arm numb. Dark blood leaked out into the dirty cloth. She hissed to herself as she ducked behind one of the stones. She still had the sword, though, and one good arm to use it. She slithered round the rock, the rough surface scraping at her back, listening. She could hear the archer's footfalls in the grass, searching for her, the soft ringing as he drew a blade. She saw him now, his back to her, looking right and left. She jumped at him with the sword, but he turned in time and caught the blade on his own. They crashed down into the grass together and rolled over in a tangle. He scrambled up, thrashing and screaming, clutching at his bloody face. The arrow sticking from her shoulder had stabbed him through the eye as they struggled on the floor. Lucky for her. She sprang forward, and the Girkish sword chopped his foot out from under him. He screamed again, falling onto his side, mangled leg flopping. He was just pushing himself up when the curved blade hacked halfway through his neck from behind. Pharaoh scrambled through the grass, away from the body, her left arm hanging nearly useless, her right fist gripped tight around the grip of the sword, looking for more work. Phineas moved this way and that, dancing around, light on his feet. He had a big square shield on his left arm, a short, thick sword in the other hand. He twirled it around as he moved, watery sun flashing on the edge, grinning all the while, long hair flapping around his face in the wind. Logan was too tired to move much, so he just stood there and caught his breath, the Maker's sword hanging down by his side.
"What happened to your sorcerer?" grinned Phineas. "No tricks this time, eh?"
"No tricks."
"Well, you've led us a merry dance, I'll give you that. But we got here in the end."
"Got where?" Logan looked down at the corpse of the brown-eyed man sat against the stone beside him.
"If this was what you wanted, you could have killed yourself days ago and saved me the trouble."
Phineas frowned.
"You'll find I'm made of different stuff from these fools, Northman."
"We're all made of the same stuff. I don't need to carve another body to find that out." Logan stretched his neck out, hefted the Maker's sword in his hand.
but if you're set on showing me your contents, I'll not disappoint you. All right, then. Phineas started forward. If you're that keen to see hell...
He came on fast and hard, the shield up in front of him, herding Logan through the stones, jabbing and chopping quick with the sword. Logan stumbled back, short of breath, looking for an opening, but not finding one.